Race Questions with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.
Hi, I'm Adam.
And I'm Sabine. Welcome to the 19th episode of Robots. Today we start a two-part special looking at ethical issues in robotics. Given the broad and controversial nature of this topic, we will speak with two world-renowned experts in ethics with often opposing views. Our first guest, Noel Sharkey, will be joining us from the University of Sheffield in the UK, while in the next episode we will hear from Ronald Arkin from Georgia Tech in the US.
Both researchers discuss issues such as military robots, robots in the society, medical robots, and legal responsibilities. Their opinions on these subjects have been widely covered by the media, international organizations, and academia. The interviews were recorded individually, and both researchers were asked the same questions. But before we get started, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, have demonstrated the first wireless control of a beetle. The insect robot, revealed at the IEEE MEMS conference in Italy this month, consists of an off-the-shelf microprocessor, a radio receiver, a battery attached to a custom-printed circuit board, and six electrodes implanted into the animal's optic lobes and flight muscles. The research, following in the footsteps of previous DARPA-funded projects demonstrating remote-controlled rats, pigeons, and sharks, marks an important milestone in miniaturizing surveillance systems. The current system harnesses the highly evolved flight control of flying insects. Future versions aim at also taking advantage of the insect's visual system and at exploiting the beetle's biological energy system as batteries. A Japanese company called Little Island will manufacture your own custom-made robotic twin. The robot is produced based on a picture you send in. What you get for your money is a 40-centimeter-tall robot doll in your image, which can connect to the internet and recite your favorite RSS feeds. The doll also reacts to simple voice commands. However, at 1,700 euros or $2,200, it's at the very pricey end for a gadget or toy for your kids. Less pricey and potentially far more useful is a new remote-controlled robot arm kit. The robot arm can sit on your desktop and has 5 degrees of freedom, including a gripper, 120-degree wrist motion, 300-degree elbow range, and a 270-degree base rotation, allowing it to reach a working area of about 38 by 32 centimeters or 15 by 12.5 inches. It can lift up to 100 grams, and an LED spotlight on its gripper can illuminate your work. Assembly of the arm requires about 2 hours and no soldering. Best of all, the robotic arm retails for a mere 38 euros or $50. For more information and discussion on this week's news, including an upcoming webcast about the remote-controlled beetle, sale of your robot doppelganger, and a video of the desktop robotic arm, visit our forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Our first guest, Noel Sharkey, is Professor of Artificial Intelligence and Robotics at the University of Sheffield in the UK. Over the years, he's been moving across fields from engineering to philosophy, psychology, and AI. In his additional role as Professor of Public Engagement, his job is to inform politicians, various public bodies, and national and international organizations about ethical problems that may arise in robotics.
Hi, Noel. Welcome to the Robots Podcast.
Hi, Adam. You're welcome.
So starting our topic about ethics today, let's start with a simple question. Why is ethics an issue in robotics?
Well, it's important because we've got an entirely new technology now, and we haven't really looked at it ethically yet. So if you have an autonomous robot doing things to people, I mean, there are so many different ethical issues. They don't all relate together across many different tasks. So if you have an autonomous robot or even a remote control robot entering our lives in a new kind of way, you need to be concerned about the ethical issues.
When did we, as scientists or as people in general, when did we start looking at ethics in robotics? And what could you say has been done so far?
Well, there's not really been a lot done so far. I'm not really sure when they started. There was talk in the New York Times, there was an article there in 1950 asking for a robot commission for military purposes because a professor in the United States believed that the military would be using robots more and more, and so we should have something like the United Nations Commission. But nothing ever happened about that until recently it's come up again. There's been a lot of talk throughout the world. In Japan, they've talked about developing a code of ethics. The Korean government 2 years ago said they were put together a number of professors and they were going to produce a new code of ethics. But there hasn't been one, and we haven't seen one. There's been, but 2 or 3 years ago, the European Union group, you know, one of those big grants you get in Europe, mm-hmm. It's called RoboEthics. I can't remember what it's called. It's a European grant anyway, and they looked at ethical issues, but they just looked at them and talked about what some of them were. Nothing has actually been set in stone yet or set in place at all.
So why are robots different? What makes them, they're just a machine in the end, what makes them different and the ethical considerations different than compared to, say, just a regular machine or...
Well, there's a couple of issues with that. For instance, ordinary machines do require a code of ethics quite often, and certainly a moral code or a safety code. So robots aren't different in that sense, but there are different ethical issues associated with robots. And as I say, it depends on their application, really. For instance, if you're using robots in the military, you really need to be concerned about how you're using them and why you're using them. But one of the problems with robots is, and why it's different from other machines, is if you make them autonomous, then you're giving them decision power, in a sense. It may just be a list of conditionals, but nonetheless, they're going to act without a human being present. Then we need to be sure about what they're actually doing.
You speak of the military, and in the last 5 to 10 years, governments have been pumping billions and billions of dollars into developing military robots. And I guess that's the first thing people think about when we say robot ethics.
So, yes, indeed, yes. I've been tracking this very, very carefully for some time now. And, I mean, it was the Americans who have got this future combat systems where they're putting in $240 billion to develop not just robots. It's a combined effort, but it's one soldier will have what you call a force multiplier. That means one soldier will be able to unleash an attack from the air and the ground simultaneously, and that would require autonomous robots. And they're quite a long way down that path to developing them. They're not using them yet. The American military are not using autonomous robots too much yet, and certainly not for killing people yet, but that is the plan. At the moment, there are something like between 4,000 and 6,000 robots being deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan. But mainly, these are for bomb disposal, which is, nobody can complain about that. There's nothing ethical about that. You don't want soldiers being killed by roadside bombs or anyone.
Yeah, definitely.
So there's not an ethical problem with that. It's only when they go towards the developing killing machines that there's a problem. And it's not just about autonomous robots, either, the ethical questions. It's about teleoperated robots. So there are only three armed teleoperated robots that have been sent to Iraq for the ground forces, and these have been not deployed yet because the rumor was it was a tail on sword. Rumor has it that when they first switched it on to operate it, it started turning towards the soldiers themselves, and so it was cancelled. This has been denied by Talon, but it's nonetheless there. But the other kind of robot being used heavily is the aerial robot. So aerial robots such as the Predator and the Reaper, that's unmanned autonomous vehicles, and they're flown by pilots who are in the Nevada desert in America, 3,000 miles away, and they're being used quite heavily for decapitation raids in Afghanistan, where they wouldn't risk, in Pakistan, northern Pakistan, so where they wouldn't risk a normal pilot. So these are quite worrisome as well, because anything that can be teleoperated can eventually be controlled by computer rather than being remote controlled, and that's a great concern to me.
What would you say are the major ethical questions in teleoperated robots, such as the ones you just mentioned? Why is it worse or ethically different than just sending a regular fighter plane with a pilot inside it? What are the dangers, maybe?
There are quite a few things. It leads ethically, I mean, I'd rather talk about the ethics of autonomous robots, but while we're on this, it leads to overreaching the technology. You don't need, there's not very much intelligence coming through from North Pakistan. And so these planes are being flown over and you're using visual systems to detect people. And the people sitting 3,000 miles away are really engaged in the computer game. They talk about the stress of these pilots because what happens is they're sitting there fighting in a combat zone in Afghanistan. And then they're popping home for their evening meal with their family. So it's a kind of odd sort of computer gamey type thing. But ethically, what you're doing is, it's not so much because it's a robot, but because they're overreaching the technology and able to hover, for instance, for 72 hours at a time, looking down. And what happens is they keep killing the wrong people. You're looking from the air, so they're searching all the time with these surveillance things. For instance, a couple of times they've mistaken people, local people, for being Bin Laden because they're tall and thin and have a beard. And so they've killed the wrong people. But mainly, every time you hear about these decapitation raids, what you find out is that several children have been killed. Several women have been killed. And quite often, they do DNA analysis afterwards in the villages where the attack has been. And very often, the target is actually not there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something morally wrong with the idea of a decapitation raid anyway. This is only permitted because we've got these UAVs that are teleoperated. A normal fighter jet can fly in and do a raid, but because these things are loitering munitions, they can hover for quite a while. They change the nature of things. And the decapitation raid really is an odd thing because in America...
I'm sorry, could you explain what a decapitation raid is?
Yes, I'll explain it in detail.
Okay.
let me put it in context. In the United States, President Ford onwards, after the Vietnamese War, the CIA were implicated in a lot of assassinations throughout the world, political assassinations. And the American president, the American people decided this is not something that a civilized country should be engaged with. So they produced this presidential order, which was renewed by every president throughout. It's not a legal thing, but it's a presidential executive order, and it's been renewed by every president since, including President Reagan. And it became presidential order 12333, and that says that you must not assassinate people. Now, what's happened under the Bush administration is this changed so that instead of having assassinations, you have decapitations. Now, what they did was they declared a war on terror. Now, a lot of people thought that was a crazy idea, a war on terror. But by calling it a war, it had legal implications. So it set out terrorists, insurgents, as combatants. And combatants are legal targets. Although these particular combatants aren't given the right of normal soldiers, they're not given prisoner of war rights. But by being combatants, it means they could be attacked. And the notion of decapitation means you're decapitating the institution of Al-Qaeda by taking away its leaders. So you're decapitating the organization, not the person. And that's a decapitation raid. And these are made possible by having these UAVs, which are remote controlled. And they're happening with increasing regularity.
Mm-hmm. So maybe getting back to robots then, would you say military robots are a good development for the field of robotics? In the way that they at least advance robotics?
Yes. They're pumping out a lot of money. As you said yourself, there are millions, billions going into robotic development. And it's happening worldwide. It's not just in the United States. It's happening in China, Israel, and Russia are all developing military robots now and selling them worldwide. Israel's one of the biggest sellers. And so the developments are happening quite quickly, and I think it's really improving the field of robotics, yes, but at a price.
So, Noel, what would you say are the ethical issues of autonomous robots?
Well, at the moment, having a robot that can make discriminations between people is quite unethical because of something called the principle of discrimination. There's also the principle of proportionality. But let me explain the principle of discrimination. It's part of the laws of war enmeshed there, as enshrined in the Geneva Convention and all the protocols since. And the idea there is that you must not, if possible, you must not harm a civilian. You must not harm a non-combatant, anyone not wearing a uniform, essentially, although now with insurgent war that's slightly changed. And it goes beyond harming a civilian. It goes towards mentally ill soldiers or prisoners of war. Now, at the present, there are no AI systems with the sensing ability to discriminate between a civilian and a soldier, unless you convinced all the insurgents and all the other armies to wear RFID tags or some sort of bright-colored uniform. There is no way of making that discrimination. Now, it's worse than that because, as you know, in order to make a computer discriminate from something, you have to be able to define it very clearly. A computer can compute anything or discriminate between anything that's clearly defined and if it's got appropriate sensing. Now, if we look at the definition of what a civilian is, and we can look here to the 1947 Geneva Convention, and what they say is a soldier should use common sense to discriminate. Now, in the 1977 Protocol 1 addition to the Geneva Convention, they try a little bit harder to define what a civilian is, but they end up by saying, essentially, a civilian is someone who is not a soldier or not a combatant. So we do not have a clear definition of what a civilian is. So even if we had the sensing capabilities, which we don't have, and I can't see us having in the near future, we cannot discriminate between a civilian and a combatant. Therefore, applying an autonomous robot or deploying an autonomous robot in a battlefield situation where it has to discriminate between civilians and combatants is ethically incorrect according to the laws of war. You're allowed also, you're allowed to kill some civilians, as you may know. This goes back to St. Augustine and the law of double effect. Nowadays we call it collateral damage. And the idea there is that any civilian casualties should be proportional to the military advantage. Now, the United States military have some software to help them with this called Bugsplat. And you employ that to see what the overall effect will be of dropping a bomb, for instance, so they can choose, like much like a caddy in a golf game chooses a club, you can choose a bomb accordingly so that you have minimized civilian casualties, though it doesn't work very well, to be honest. But there's no software you could put on a robot to make its response proportional. Now, there are legal ways around this. You can, for instance, when you're using cluster munitions or whatever, or bombing raids, you can define what the military call a kill box. And inside a kill box, anything goes. You can kill anything within that kill box, but nothing outside of it. And you could do similarly with a robot, where you could define a kill box and it will kill anything it finds within there. For instance, in the South Korea, they've put border guards along there built by Samsung, or they're in the process of doing so, that can kill on site up to 4 kilometers away. Now, that's in the DMZ or the demilitarized zone, and under the laws of war, it's perfectly legal to kill anybody who enters the demilitarized zone. So autonomous robots would be legal in that circumstance. And you might have some moral issues with that, but under the laws of war, it wouldn't be unethical. Another point about this is that people often say on blog sites, etc., oh, this is great, it's going to save our soldiers' lives. That's the big thing about robots. Or let's have a war where it's all robots, because one of the things is proliferation. Now, the problem with having a war where it's all robots is that if robots fight each other, that's all well and good. But no side will ever accept that as being the victor. So traditional warfare will have to follow anyway. Otherwise, why not sit down and play a chess game to decide instead of using robots? That's one thing. Now, the other thing is people talk about a risk-free war, but there's no such thing as a risk-free war. On the one hand, it's only risk-free for one side, as in the United States at the minute, but it's not really risk-free to their civilians, because what happens is the mightier an army becomes in the sense of being risk-free, the more danger there is to civilians, say, traveling abroad. So it could get to the point where if the American military are using nothing but robots, no American citizen will be able to travel abroad without being targeted. The other problem with risk-free war is that one of the big things is the body bag count. I mean, nobody wants to see anybody being killed. I certainly don't want to see soldiers being killed at all. But the body bag count is one of the the Americans have something called the Dover test. And what the Dover test is the number of body bags arriving at Dover Airport back from war zones. You look at what the electoral, this is a bit cynical, but you look at what the electoral effect is. And if the electorate don't start, if the polls don't say that the electorate is turning against the president, then that's passed the Dover test. So the body bag count is very important to hold back on starting wars. If your wars are risk-free and no soldiers are involved, then it might be much easier politically to start more and more wars and easier to start them. So none of this is really risk-free. And that's the big worry about robots.
So maybe as a last question on military robots, where do you see the future of war and the robots that will be used in war in the next few years? Where do you think it's heading, and at which point will we stop?
I can tell you where it could be heading, and I could say, and I hope it doesn't head there, and I hope that we as a robotics community can stop it from heading there by being ethically responsible about what we're doing for the military. But where it seems to be heading is towards all-out autonomous warfare. For instance, last year, BAE Systems, it's a British company, tested what they called a team of autonomous planes that could acquire targets, that could acquire targets for themselves, talk to each other like a sort of swarm robotics thing, and decide among themselves which target each would acquire. So the technology's there. The technology's also there for ground forces. As you know, the DARPA challenge, which is the American defense race across the desert, has been very successful. So there are a number of autonomous vehicles. And they've led, for instance, to the Carnegie Mellon Crusher robot, which is a massive 7-ton truck that can crush a Cadillac, and it can run completely autonomously. Now, I know that South Africa, Korea, and the UK have also set up these challenges, and there's one in Europe as well. And, for instance, Germany is acquiring a lot of robots. Everybody is acquiring robots because the Iraq and Afghanistan have been a showcase. So it looks like we're going to go all out and acquire many, many more robots, both in the air and the ground. And we really need to reevaluate the laws of war to take these into account. Now, quite often the robot technology, for instance, cluster munitions, are becoming much more like robots. For instance, the Blue 108, for instance, has got, what happens is that it drops out of a plane as 40 cylinders drop out of a machine, and as they come close to the ground, they spin back up again, and they fire four warheads each, covering 360 feet. And these warheads spin in the air. They have lasers on board, infrared detectors, and they look for warm bodies. And when they see a warm body, like a tank or a bus, then they fire the warhead and get it. But what the American military are doing now is developing these same type of weapons, but they're pursuit weapons. So they fire the warhead, they search for a hot body, and if the hot body is moving away quickly, they will pursue it. So I see a very, very bleak future with these robots unless we can get international agreement about changing the nature of warfare. I mean, I read every day that Turkey, for instance, are developing now armed UAVs that they get from Israel. India are developing them, and Russia have put a lot of development in place for armed UAVs in the last couple of weeks. China already have them. So we're getting there very, very quickly, and it's a bit scary.
Let's switch gears maybe and move a bit away from the military robots and speak about other types of robots, prosthetics and medical robots, for example. More and more we see advanced prosthetics coming into existence. They have now robot arms that can sense and feel and be controlled completely through the thoughts of a person. What kind of ethical issues do you think this brings, this idea of being able to replace our anatomical systems with robotic parts?
The first thing that springs to mind about the advanced prosthetics, the first word that springs to my mind is wonderful. I think they're a really good thing. They're incredible to help anybody disabled, of course. And it's the same not just with prosthetic limbs, but a lot of the technology is going into implants now that can be put into people's brains. As you say, thought control, it's helping people with cerebral palsy, with Parkinson's disease, fixing out the tremors and things. And there are no real ethical questions about that kind of application. Where the ethical questions come into play is in terms of enhancement. So if you're enhancing, if you're perfectly normal to begin with, sorry, I use the word normal loosely there, mm-hmm. if you're not disabled or you don't have a medical condition and you start using these things to enhance yourself, then we have to ask questions about them. For instance, if I can just go beyond robots and talk about sort of artificial intelligence implants, mm-hmm. if you can improve your intelligence, for instance, I mean, you can do that already with drugs like Ritalin. We know that American students all over the United States are using them for the university entrance exams, and they can boost your IQ points up a little bit, you know, about 10 points, actually, temporarily, though we don't know the side effects. Mm-hmm. Now, people are talking about having that kind of AI implant in the brain so you can boost intelligence and stuff. And the main problem with that, really, ethically, is between the haves and the have-nots. Already, richer people can afford a much better education than poor people. But nonetheless, some poor people can slip through the net because they're born smart or they just have, you know, something special. I mean, I was born into a very working-class family myself, and so I feel the impact of this and had not got a good education whatsoever, but managed to slip through the net later in life. And if you start having all kinds of enhancements that cost a fortune, then we need to look at, you know, will the haves have this? And there's no chance for the poor to ever reach that point. Now, currently, I'm actually working with our shadow cabinet, that's the government in waiting kind of thing, on these issues. They're taking them very seriously. I mean, they are coming up.
What kind of ethical issues maybe does it raise to use robots to take care of our elderly and to take care of our sick instead of taking care of them ourselves, for example?
Yes, there's quite a lot of... There are a number of different ethical issues there, actually, depending on the equipment being used. Now, with elder care, there's a kind of moral dilemma, really, or an ethical dilemma. On the one hand, these devices can really improve the quality of an old person's life. And one thing they can do is keep an old person out of care homes for longer. So if you're living at home and you have trouble feeding yourself, for instance, the MySpoon made by Seachem can feed you. So it's a little bit humiliating. I would find it a little bit humiliating being fed by somebody, but you clamp this robot arm onto your tray and it will help to feed you. They will also come and you can grab the robot and it can lift you up and navigate you to the toilet. There are robots that can wash an old person now. So robots can get involved in many areas of care. Now in Japan, the demographic is a little bit different than Europe. I mean, we're developing slowly an aged population that's going to really outnumber our young. And in Japan, that's more severe than in Europe at the minute, although we're getting there. And Japan also has a problem with not having much immigrant labor. So they've reached for the machines to help them. That's kind of a Japanese cultural thing, and it's fair enough. And so they're further ahead with us in terms of this elder care. And it could all be very good. But why it's a moral dilemma is simply that as the technology gets better and better and better, and the robots can do more and more for old people, they might be left solely in the care of the robots, or too much in the care of robots. Now, certainly in my country here, in the UK, what happens is that elderly people can live at home for long, you know, as long as they can, when they're not taken into a care home. And while they're living at home, people will come called Meals and Wheels, and they will bring food to them every day. Other people will come in three times a day, care workers, to make sure that they're okay, give them a quick wash maybe, or get them something, get their book for them that they need. Now, for some old people, this is the only human contact they have. And it is the moral responsibility of a society to make sure that all people have some human contact, some love and care. Now, if we start giving if we start getting robot technology, which is so advanced that we don't need meals and wheels because the robots can cook for them, can look after them in their daily lives, we don't need carers coming in except to maybe maintain the robots, then there's a problem there because the old people are not getting human love and care. Now, you mentioned there the Paro robot. There's the Paro robot. Well, there's lots of Japanese robots that are developing, such as, you know, Japanese companions. And, you know, that's one way that the Japanese have moved towards the idea of, well, the elderly people can't just be looked over by robots. They also need some sort of contact, some sort of care. And so they've moved towards giving them these cuddly seals or these cuddly dogs. And the problem there is quite strange because research in Japan has shown that elderly people seem to pick up, they get, you know, they're boosted by these pets rather than just sitting in a care home on their own. They seem to, when research has been conducted on them, the pets seem to have actually helped them and made them, you know, boosted their morale and made them feel better. But the danger there really is that in the research itself, researchers are coming in to investigate what the effect of these robots are. And certainly Sherry Turkle from MIT has suggested that it's actually the extra contact with the researchers which is boosting their morale and not the pets themselves. So there's a bit of a problem there. And Rob Sparrow, who's an ethical philosopher, doesn't like the idea. I'm not sure about it, but he doesn't like the idea of the robot pets because he says that they're embarking on a kind of deception with the old people. If you're old and vulnerable, there's deception there. Now, there's also the issue of companions. I'm just listing some, pumping out ethical issues here. Mm-hmm. The issue with companions with the elderly, again, there's a kind of moral dilemma here. You've got people with Alzheimer's, etc., and the companion can act as a memory aid. It can act as a conversational aid, so they can chat to it. And a lot of people working in the companions field have talked about building up biographical data of old people so that their children can have it later. But the problem with that is that with an elderly person who's not in a position to give consent, who might be an Alzheimer's person, might be giving away a lot of private data that in their normal life, when they were young, they might not want to give away. They might be talking about their children. I mean, we all talk about our parents and parents all talk about their children, but they don't really mean any harm by it. But it can, you know, you might say, oh, my daughter's always been hopeless at tidying up or something. And that's okay as a casual comment. But as a record, so that the child can then hear it, it could be quite offensive to the child. And it might make them reflect differently on the parent. So there are issues of privacy and dignity here as well, I think.
I guess for the average you and me, one of the major problems with robotics would be them taking over our jobs, perhaps. Do you believe that we should be worried about this or maybe happy that robots are taking over the menial tasks of
Yes, it's not life? It's not something that I really worry about because in the early 80s and mid-80s, I was called in to do quite a few radio interviews because people were really concerned about the development of the PC and how it was beginning to take over jobs. For instance, the printers union were really complaining. They lost a lot of work, etc. And people were really worried about mass unemployment at the time with the rise of the computer and the internet, etc. But actually, it actually led to an awful lot more jobs, and the jobs got a lot better for people. I mean, you work in a university department now, as I do, and the life of the secretary in a university department is really quite different now. It's a much more creative, much more fulfilling job. They're not sitting in a typing pool with academics coming in and then saying, type this paper for me and typing it out and that sort of thing. They're able to do much more high-level work. And I think it's the same with the input of robotics. I don't think it will cut down on jobs. I think it will create more jobs. But I think they will manage to take away a lot of menial work. It's interesting that you should say this because I was talking in India recently and I was talking about, you know, what robots would do and the various tasks they would do because one of the big things, of course, we haven't discussed because we've been talking about ethical issues is that robots were really designed to do dull, dirty and dangerous work. And in India, they found this very amusing because they said, well, why wouldn't you get a servant so cheap? Would you want robots to do the work for you? But I was pointing out to them that, you know, some of the things they do, well, the lower castes, for instance, are having to go and clean out people's toilets and do really, really filthy work. And I think they're beneath human dignity, some of the jobs that people have to do. And certainly sewage work is not something anybody wants to do, and robots are doing that. But you need people to control the robots. You need people to program them. You need people up on the surface to get them out. You know, so it does not, I don't think it will take away work from us at all. And I think it will lead to greater human dignity.
So, Noel, after you've pointed out all these ethical issues with robots, what do you think we should do about it? What kind of policies do we need to put into place?
Well, you see, for me as an academic and as a professor of public engagement, I see my role very much as finding out what the potential dangers are with emerging technologies, both morally, ethically, and in terms of safety. And my job is to point these out both to the public, the policymakers, and to professional organizations such as the military, childcare organizations, elder care organizations, and even the police I'm talking to the Japanese police at the moment. And so I can point out what the ethical dangers are. But, you know, I don't know enough about politics. I don't know enough about the codes myself. It's not my job to really tell people what they should do. I'm not a dictator. So by pointing out the issues and asking the public to really look into these, I'm hoping that we'll get sort of international legislation or even codes of ethics being sent up. Certainly in terms of childcare, when I've looked at the law, and I do look at the international law as well, I find very little protection in terms of robots. So as these new technologies are emerging, all we need is the professional organizations themselves to look at them and say how they should be used. Now, some of the professional organizations I talk to, particularly in childcare, simply say, this is ridiculous. We're not going to have this at all. We're going to reject this, and we're not having anything to do with it. But I think, I'm still talking to them, I think that's perhaps the wrong approach, because whether they want to reject them or not, they're going to come. So you better to be realistic about it and actually try to develop codes of ethics. So as academics, it's our responsibility to look at the ethical issues of any of the technology we develop and point it out to people who are concerned. For instance, I would say to people who are working with the military, for instance, is to be very careful what they talk about. Now, we all, in academia, it's very common for us all to discuss AI. We're all philosophically lent as well to talk about the future of AI and how machines are going to get very intelligent and work out trajectories of intelligence based on Moore's Law and extra things that are going to happen. But really, we should stop ourselves when it comes to human safety and human lives, particularly the lives of the innocent, and think, what is the technology doing now, and what's it likely to be doing over the next 5 years realistically? Stop talking about superintelligence and those kinds of things. Keep them for academic debate. When the military come to see you with a pocket full of money, and they have come to see me with pockets full of money, tell them the truth, because the military believe, and they're led to believe, that artificial intelligence is a lot more advanced than it is. And when they come to you with several million dollars for your lab, it's very tempting to just nod your head and go along with them. Don't do that. We should all be realistic so that they know exactly what they're getting into.
Once we get more and more intelligent and autonomous robots, who at the end of the day has the responsibility for the actions of a robot? Both a military robot, say, that might kill a civilian, and even a robot in our home. I mean, a Roomba is not going to kill anybody, but more advanced robots might injure people. Who in the end has the responsibility for these actions?
That's a very good question, and it's one that's been debated quite a lot, both by the legal profession, philosophers, and roboticists. And it's a very interesting question. Now, it entirely depends on the application of the robot. Different people can be responsible for different parts. But let me start by saying that one thing that will not be responsible, certainly at the minute, is the robot. You can't hold a robot accountable in my books. There's no way you can punish a robot. What are you going to do? Say, I'll turn you off. I mean, the robot's not going to care less. As I say, I'd rather talk realistic about robots and artificial intelligence as it exists today because of dangers, rather than some fantasy robot or some robot that might exist in the future in principle. So the robot cannot be held accountable. Now, some lawyers I know argue that a robot could be held accountable because although it's not a person and although you can't punish it, corporate law may cover this, because corporate law isn't about persons either, it's about corporations. But it's, you know, that's very debatable to me, and I'm not sure about that. Now, otherwise, one of the problems with deploying a robot is that it is very, very difficult to assign responsibility. I mean, that's one of the problems with using them. In the military, for instance, who's responsible if a robot kills civilians? Is it the commander who sent the robot out? Is it the soldier who's with it? Is it the politicians who sent it in the first place? Is it the robot manufacturer? Supposing, for instance, a robot goes into a village and just slaughters people. Who was responsible for doing that? Was it the manufacturer who might not have got the software right? Or was it the government responsible for doing it? You certainly can't try a robot for war crimes, although there may be attempts to do that. So there's always the question there, could a robot be ethical or have a sense of ethics? And I think the answer to that for the moment, and I don't know when in the future it will be otherwise, is clearly no. A robot can't have a sense of ethics. What you could do is program a list of rules into a robot, but it would blindly follow those rules. Like one of those little car parking attendants you meet who can't see a context, like, oh, I've got a flat tire, so I can't pay more money for my parking. Well, you're still parked there. So people who blindly follow rules are not really considered to be very useful ethically. I mean, in AI, people have looked at the idea of having judges, but the problem is judgments are really contextually sensitive and require human judgment. So I'm not sure that you can actually have an ethical robot. Now, Ron Arkin in the United States at Georgia Tech has been developing the idea of an artificial conscience for a robot. And so has John Canning at the Naval Research Base in Virginia. And both are very well-meaning. The idea is that, well, Ron Arkin's idea is that a robot will be installed with the laws of war so that it won't kill innocent people. And his heart is definitely in the right place. And what he's doing, he's developing a list of rules, essentially, which are the laws of war, and they'll exist as conditionals, a mathematical decision space inside the robot. So a simple example could be, if this person is an innocent, a non-combatant, don't shoot them. Now, where this runs aground for me in one instance is that I don't think the robot can have any sense of context, and there's no AI reasoning system that you could use at the minute that would give it that sort of sense. But the real problem for me, again, is going back to what I said earlier about discrimination. There's no point having a set of rules if the robot cannot sensorily perform the discrimination. So if a robot can't tell the difference between an innocent and a civilian, what's the point in having the background system of rules? So that's the problem there. Now, John Canning has a very sensible approach. He's a chief naval engineer. And his idea is, let men kill men, let machines kill machines. And his idea is, develop military robots that will only target weapons. And if someone happens to be holding the weapon, they'll be killed, of course. But the robot will say, drop your weapon or whatever. Now, at the moment, this is a bit of a fantasy as well, as John Canning admits to me, because we can't tell weapons at a distance yet, but it's a possibility in the future. So that's one approach that might work a little bit.
Well, thank you very much, Noel, for your insight, and it was a pleasure having you on Robots.
Well, thank you, Adam. It's been a pleasure as well, and it's good that I can get this out to a wider audience.
That's it for part one of our special on ethics in robotics. Be sure to listen to our next episode, where we will hear a very different opinion from our second expert, Ronald Arkin. For more information on our guests, or to give your opinion on the ethics of robotics, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Raise Questions with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.